Editorial cartoonists use illustration to offer a different perspective on the news. And in doing so, they challenge us to think. Today's guest brings a conservative perspective to his cartoons for the Indy Star. He's Gary Varvel, this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello, and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller from the Providence Journal. Story in the Public Square is an effort to study, celebrate, and tell stories that matter. We do that by visiting each week with the best contemporary storytellers, authors, scholars, filmmakers, and editorial cartoonists, really anyone using and studying narrative to explain the world in which we live. This week, we're joined by Gary Varvel, an editorial cartoonist for the Indy Star, a filmmaker, and an author. Gary, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So we want to talk about your work, but tell us a little bit, how did you find this line of work? How did you get to where you are today?
I always like to draw. My parents encouraged me in that. When I was in high school, I met the cartoonist for the Indianapolis News, a guy named Jerry Barnett. And he told me that I had talent, and he thought I could do it if I really applied myself. And that became the dream of becoming an editorial cartoonist. 1974, it was the beginning of the dream. It only took me 20 years.
that's faster than most. Did you go to school? Is there something that you study, or is it sort of like an apprenticeship that you've got to learn how to do this
There's
stuff?
No schools for editorial cartooning. Yeah. I mean, this is a self-taught. What I did was I kind of deconstructed cartoons of the people I really liked. You know, at the time I was coming along, Jeff McNelly was probably one of the best, Pat Oliphant. Yeah. I loved Mike Peters' work, although I didn't agree with him politically. But that became my passion, is to figure out how are these guys do this. And I figured it out, I guess. But, you know, I'm an overnight success. It took 20 years. 16 years that I got a job working for the Indianapolis News as a chief artist. And I worked in the newsroom, but for 16 years I applied to jobs all over the country and was rejected from everyone.
Did they know that? Did your bosses know you were applying for jobs?
Oh, yeah, right.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't make it. I mean, everybody yeah. knew that my goal was to become an editorial cartoonist. And then in 1994, the cartoonist for the Indianapolis Star, a guy named Charlie Warner, won the Pulitzer Prize in 1939.
Wow.
He'd been at the Star for 47 years, and he took retirement, and fortunately, I got the job.
So when you started chasing this dream, at the Indianapolis News, how many cartoonists were on staff? How many illustrators?
It's interesting. When I first met Jerry Barnett, he told me there were 200 editorial cartoonist jobs in the country.
In the country.
And today there's probably less than 30.
Wow.
That's, you know, illustrative, of course, of larger changes in journalism in general. In your early days, what were the themes that you were striking in your cartoons, and what were your political views? And then we'll get into whether they've evolved or remained the same.
In the early days, like in the 80s when I was trying to get the job?
No, let's say in the 90s.
In the 90s.
When you finally did get the job.
Well, let me back up just for a second, because
sure.
In 1988, I had an interesting interview for a job in Columbus, Columbus Dispatch. A guy named Luke Feck was the editor, and I call it the best and worst interview I ever had in my life, because it was the worst, because he said to me, look, you are better than most people who draw doing this job, but I don't detect any fire in the belly in you. I don't know what you're passionate about, because it doesn't come through your work. Now, that was worse to hear, but at the same time, it was the best, because somebody needed to tell me that. Where am I lacking? Why am I not getting the job? And so that began kind of a change, a paradigm shift for me, not just politically, but also, you know, saying something with the cartoon that mattered. I was studying the Bible every day. Every day I'd read a chapter a day. And the Bible changed me. It changed my worldview. And so I became more conservative, I guess, And so when 1994 came around, my cartoons had a message, and that was the big difference. I think that's also, I think that I had been rejected from these other jobs. I think in retrospect, I think that God was preserving me for the job I have now. And fortunately, I get to do the, you know, the job that I've always wanted to do in my hometown. Very few guys get to do that. Usually you have to go wherever the job is.
And I think it's a fair assessment to say that you're a conservative Christian, and, yeah, and your cartoons and your writings reflect that. I want to back up a second here. You started reading the Bible. Was this something that prompted you to do that? Were you from a religious family? Did you come across that? Did you have a personal crisis? What happened?
No, I grew up in a Christian home. I often say that my daughter drove me to Christ, because when she was born in 1984, it was one of those cases where it was kind of a wake-up call for me. Did I want my daughter following in my footsteps? And I didn't like the path I was on. So I basically prayed, Lord, I can't change me. You're going to have to change me. But I did change one thing. I started reading the Bible every morning. We started going to church consistently, you know, every week. And it changed my marriage. It changed, and not, we had a good marriage, but it helped us. And it transformed me as far as, you know, when you have the big issues of the day, I'm not that smart. How do you be sure about you're in the right place or you're saying the right message on whatever issue it is? I decided to go back to the rule book. Let's go to the owner's manual and see how it's supposed to work. And, you know, I think it addresses a lot of issues that we deal with.
Well, so your work is remarkable, and we want to talk a little bit about some of the some of your cartoons, so some of your greatest hits over the years. And one of the ones that struck me was a cartoon that you did after the attacks of 9/11 with a firefighter and a fallen firefighter chaplain and Uncle Sam. Tell our audience about that and the genesis of the story behind.
Well, everybody knows where they were on 9/11, and we ran a special edition that day. We've not done that very often, and I was told at that time I had an hour deadline. And I, at that point, I knew nothing other than we were being attacked. I didn't know by who. And, of course, over the next couple of days, then you started to hear things. I think I did this on the second day. But one of the things in watching the towers come down, I started thinking about the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995.
Oh, yeah.
And the famous photograph was this firefighter carrying this small child. And I thought, how ironic that the firefighters become the victim. And so I drew Uncle Sam, which represented the United States, you know, in a tear in his eye, carrying this firefighter. Now, I didn't intend for it to be a chaplain. At that time, I didn't know the story about the chaplain. But I put this kind
Father
of cross.
Mike Judge. Yeah.
Exactly. And so after the fact, people told me it looked just like him, so we did the poster, we did the cartoon, it ran, and then my editor decided to make it into a poster, and we sold it to raise money for the relief effort in New York, and we raised $130,000 on the sale of the cartoon.
That's remarkable.
Well, that's great. It's a very powerful image, too, and what a great outcome in terms of the money you raised, too. So, fast forward a little bit, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq begin, they continue. And of course, in the early days of that, Osama bin Laden was the most sought after target in the world. And eventually he was killed. And you did a cartoon that is captioned "An Eye for an Eye." And it shows bin Laden, and in his eye is, I guess, a special forces person. Yeah. Again, a very powerful image. What inspired, we know what inspired that. How did you come to this as the final outcome? You could have done a million different things.
So it's May 1st, 2011. It's a Sunday, and the news report comes across. And my wife tells me, hey, turn on the TV. I was in my office, in my home, and I started watching. And I thought, all right, I'm at work now, because I've got to document this. We've got to figure this out. And I'm going to draw this for the next day. And so first thought that came to my mind is I could draw bin Laden in hell. And then I thought, everybody's going to do that.
Yeah.
So what else is there?
I think a lot of people did do that.
So I started reading the stories, the initial stories. And one of the things that I read was that the Navy SEAL that shot him in the left eye and in the chest. And I thought, the left eye. What if I have the reflection of the mastermind of terror in the last moments of his life is terrorized because he sees this gun pointed right at him. And so I made the pupil, the barrel of the gun, and then the Navy SEAL is in the eye reflected. And I closed in tight. In order to focus the attention on the eye, I've got to crop his face. But I think that Bin Laden has such a familiar face that even if I cropped it all out, people would know who it is.
Yeah, I think if you looked at that without any of the context you've just given us, we would know what that was.
Right.
Or who that was.
And so I'm drawing it. I'm in my office the next morning, and I'm drawing this. My daughter worked at the Indianapolis Star at that time as a graphic designer. She comes into my office, looks over my shoulder, and says, "Oh, an eye for an eye." That became the caption.
Just like that. That really?
Yeah, it was the first thought that came to her mind when she saw it, and I hadn't thought of it, and I put the caption on there. It was perfect.
That's remarkable.
Well, it's brilliant.
Let me ask you a question about how you work. So how many cartoons do you have to produce each week?
Okay, since 94, I've always done six a week.
Six a week?
Six a week?
Yeah, until last October when I started writing a column. And so I write a column, and I also put together a newsletter called Views from the Right, which you can sign up for if you go to GaryVarvel.com. Scroll down.
Good plug.
Yeah. sign up for Views from the Right. It's a conservative newsletter, but so because I do those two things, I'm only drawing four a week now and writing the column.
Four a week. Yeah. So tell us. Yeah, so I'm fascinated by this because the deadline, the pressure of the deadline, is that a motivator? How do you find fresh ideas? How do you work?
It's a big motivator.
Yeah.
You know what they call people who miss deadlines? Unemployed. So,
so I hope my editors aren't watching or listening to this show.
So I have to meet deadlines. I mean, and so. I had a pastor years ago said that the amount of time it takes to do a particular task is the amount of time that you have to do it.
Yeah.
And I find that as the deadline gets closer, I speed up quite a bit. Charles Schulz said that he never had writer's block because he's a professional. He said, but I've had a lot of bad days.
That's pretty good.
And I have a lot of bad days. There are times when, you know, sometimes the brilliance will strike, and then sometimes it's just you meet the deadline.
Are there other days, though, where, like, so I keep a little notebook because I've got one weekly deadline that I have to meet.
Yeah.
And I need a fresh idea every week. But I keep a notebook with me. It's in my car. It's at my desk. Yeah. And it's a thought comes to me like, oh, I might play with that later. And I jot that down. Do you work the same way? Are you constantly sort of cataloging ideas that you might come back to?
Yeah, I have notes all over the place. And I'm a typical artist, so I'm not organized. I have pieces of paper that I have notes on. And sometimes I don't throw things away, so I'll go back through those notes, and sometimes I find a gem that wasn't right for that time. I also make notes in notes on my computer, and I'll go back through those, and things strike me. I hear a quote. That's an interesting quote. I've got to keep that.
Yeah.
Sometimes I can plug those into a column. The mind is going 24/7, it seems like. Yeah.
So let's fast forward to the Donald Trump era.
Yes.
And a cartoon, Six Stages of Grief. And it's got six panels that begin with the election of Donald Trump. And this is from a Democrat point of view, and it's shock and pain. And it goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 to hope, and hope is impeach Trump. Tell us about that cartoon.
Well, I get to thinking as I'm watching the coverage that the Democrats are shocked. I mean, if you looked at the faces the night of the election, I mean, they just so expected Hillary to win. This was unbelievable. And then as I started watching some of the coverage, and I can't remember the exact date I did this cartoon, but I started seeing this, and I thought, they are going through the stages of grief. So I Googled stages of grief. And then I thought, you know what? This is perfect, because what they did was they went from shock to anger, and then they were saying, he's not my president. And then number three, they started bargaining. I remember they started trying to get the Electoral College guys to not vote for him.
Yeah,
you know?
I remember that. Sure.
And so then they went to blame. They started blaming the Russian hackers for the whole thing, and then the depression. They would not go to the inauguration, and then the hope is that they're going to impeach Trump. And it was perfect in my mind, and so.
What kind of reaction did you get?
Oh, both. People loved it, who were conservatives, and the people. Yeah. I'm the dumbest thing on the face of the earth to them.
Well, that must happen with many of your cartoons.
Yes, it did.
But I think that to the point though, you capture some essential truths in all of this. Right.
Right. Right. That's what you have to do. Is there's got to be a nugget of truth.
Yeah. So there's another cartoon, speaking of nuggets of truth, where you have President Trump as the batter in the batter's box, lined up with the catcher ready to receive the pitch. But the batter, the president, is facing the umpire instead of the pitcher, and he's ready to swing with the media umpire saying, shouldn't you be facing the other way?
Right.
Tell us about the genesis of that.
So I'm trying to think of how do I depict President Trump's fight or war with the media, calling them fake news and constantly berating them to their face. And so I started thinking of, you're trying to think of visual analogies. Well, I've played baseball my whole life, played men's fast pitch softball. And if somebody were to step in the box facing the wrong way, I thought, now there's a couple of ways to think about this. I mean, I could draw him actually hitting him, which is not as funny.
Right.
What makes it funny is the anticipation. So in cartooning, you're showing an image of what is going to happen or something that just happened. And so you don't show the actual event. And so the anticipation of it, you know, him standing there looking aggressively like he's going to swat the umpire, I thought was a good image to kind of say it. And I like to try to do things with very few words. Yeah. The image tells a story.
But so now you are a conservative columnist. Yeah. You've written about how you were sort of converted to support Donald Trump. This is ostensibly critical of the president or his attitude towards the press. Reconcile those two.
You know, even if I support somebody's policies, I can still criticize them if I think that they're over the line. And I've always done that. I've criticized Republicans a lot over the years, although I agree with them politically in a lot of issues. As I started looking through Trump, I drew him as a clown in the beginning. I didn't really take his candidacy seriously when he first announced, when he came down the escalator.
Yeah.
But as time was going on, and I was uncomfortable during the campaign, the debates where he's calling people names, and I didn't like that. I still don't like it.
Yeah.
It was effective. He got all the attention. But as he's been in office, the things that he's been pushing for, I can't help it. I agree with. And I think the economy has turned around based a lot on what his decisions have been. So, I had to admit, all right, that this is a case where I would go along with him. Now, I still don't go along with everything.
Yeah.
I'm still skeptical about a lot of things, but I will still be critical from time to time.
So this is the moment we've all been waiting for, or at least I've been waiting for. And you have kindly offered to draw here a caricature of Donald Trump. And describe as you're doing this what is happening here.
So it's interesting that all I have to do if I go out speaking and I draw a caricature of Trump, all I have to do is draw his hair. Everybody immediately knows that's Trump. So I just draw the hair and nobody and nothing else. But he has a white eyebrows, and he has a squinty eyes and his nose. And then he has this really interesting, prominent, pouty lips thing that he does. So, and that's it. That's about as fast as I can draw it.
That's remarkable.
That is remarkable.
So, if you're doing a caricature, are you emphasizing certain characteristics? What makes it a caricature as opposed to a
There's
portrait?
There's two things that I go by, and one is you simplify. Okay, so you don't draw the iris and the pupil and all of that stuff. You just it's a dot that gets it. Or if they have squinty eyes, just a line. So you simplify, but you also exaggerate. So you make things bigger than they are. You look at what's prominent about that character. Now, this is another thing that I learned on my own. Mad Magazine was my teacher. Mort Drucker, I think, who would do these movie parodies. And my dad used to buy Mad Magazine for my brother and I. And I just sit at home, and I would draw. I practiced drawing, and that's how I learned how to do it.
So you mentioned movies, and you are a filmmaker yourself.
Yeah.
And you are part of a company called House of Grace Films.
Yeah.
What is House of Grace Films?
Well, it's the executive director is my oldest son, Brett. Brett Varvel is the executive director. And when he was in college, he was went to Ball State studying telecommunications. And he's a gifted filmmaker. And so when he was young, I would write these scripts for these short films, and he'd go make them. And
these were like home movies type things.
Well,
it was
more than that.
Okay.
You know, he was telling stories.
Okay.
In the senior year of high school, he won a state competition in our state for video. Then he went to Ball State, While he was there, he won the David Letterman Scholarship twice for film.
Wow.
He won an Emmy Award. He became, as a freshman, became a director for the L.A. Showcase, which is a film that he directed. He's the first freshman that they've ever selected for that.
Boy, he is talented.
He has a gift. And so we started this collaboration. And so his senior year, he told his professors, he says, "I think God's calling me to do Christian films." They thought he was crazy. And I, at that time, got this idea for a movie called The Board. And it's what we do is we depict your soul is six characters, your mind, emotion, will, conscience, memory, and heart. I pitched the idea to him. He said, "That's fantastic. Let's do this." And those are the kinds of films that we're interested in. So we did the first one. It's a short film, and it's been translated into five languages now. It's been around the world. And with the proceeds from that, from the sales of that, we started House of Grace Films. And then in 2014, we came out with our full-length feature film, The War Within, and it won 7 film festival awards. And so it's been successful. And I tell you what, the biggest impact for me in doing the Christian films is we get responses from people who say, "Hey, I watched this film, and I'll never meet you on earth, but I plan on seeing you in heaven, and I'm thanking you because the film drew me there."
Wow.
Wow, that's powerful.
Well, let's roll a bit of The War Within for our audience, and then we'll talk about it. So, that's a powerful clip. In a nutshell, what is the message of The War Within?
The message of The War Within is we are all going through a war on the inside, a spiritual war. And we depicted it, you know, through these characters, the mind, emotion, the will, conscience, memory, and heart, that there's a tug of war. When things go wrong, how do you decide what's the right thing to do? And then we show in the film the power of God that changes everything. So in our minds, I didn't take any kind of psychology courses. I didn't do any of that. It's been my own life experience and studying the Bible. And I think I understand what it's saying. And that is saying is that all life is Jesus Christ. And that He wants to be the goal of our life. And in order to find true freedom, we have to find our master. And I think that is a relationship with God through Christ.
So let me ask you a question. So I'm a practicing Catholic, was raised, grew up, and there is, and I think our politics are probably different, but there's a difference in the way I think someone who is, do you consider yourself evangelical?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the difference between the way someone who is evangelical and the way someone who is sort of traditional Catholic might talk about their faith in the public sphere. Mm-hmm. You're very comfortable with it, and I commend you for that. I think that I was brought up to be a little bit more reticent to talk about my faith publicly. I wonder if you have any thoughts about sort of that difference between sort of an evangelical approach and maybe a more traditional, you know, mainline approach to Christianity.
Well, in the book of Acts, what God has called us to do is to be His witnesses. I will make you my witnesses. And He gave us a mission, and the mission is to make disciples of all nations and baptize them in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. So that's our mission. And so I see that as, you know, God has given me specific gifts. How does He want me to use those gifts? You know, the Bible says in Ephesians 2:10, "You are my workmanship created in Christ Jesus to do good works which I have prepared in advance for you to do." So if He's prepared, you know, I identify that this is what He wants me to do. Now, I work for a secular newspaper. You know, it's not my job to proselytize.
Right.
But what I have is I have a worldview, and it creeps into everything that's going on. So now I write about it, and it offends people. But I'm sorry. I get offended every day.
Yeah.
Okay? So I don't have a fit about it. I understand that people see the world differently, and we're all on our own journey. The thing that fascinates me about movies is that we're the star of our own film, our life, right? We're the star. And so I think that the attraction for movies is when we're watching somebody else's life, we can learn from stories from that. And that's what I want to do with the Christian film thing, and that's what we want to do with, you know, the children's books and all those kinds of things.
And you mentioned books. It's almost like there's nothing you can't do. You do books, too. And you have one out just now, I think, if I'm...
Yeah, Old Whiskers Escapes. It's a true story about Benjamin Harrison's pet goat. When he was
President Benjamin Harrison.
President, the only Indiana president. So President Benjamin Harrison, when he was president, he brought his animals to the White House. And he had a pet goat. He had a grandson that they called Baby McKee. His last name was McKee. And he had a cart that they hook up to the goat. This is a true story. It was in the newspapers back in the day. The goat got out of the yard, took off down the street with the baby on, you know, like 5 or 6
That's
year
old.
That's
a great story.
And Benjamin Harrison ran down the goat and stopped it from going into a ditch.
Wow.
And so they, you know, wrote about it. And so we thought, that's a great children's book. And it would teach them history, but also make it fun. And then I had a ball drawing it.
That's remarkable. Well,
so you can get the book on Amazon.com.
Beautiful, beautiful. And Gary Varvel, it's a remarkable body of work that you've put together. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
He's Gary Varvel with the Indy Star. That's all the time we have this week. But if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter or visit PellCenter.org, where you can also catch up on previous episodes. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.